Today I'm talking to Ana Castillo about her new book of memoirs, Black Dove. And we're sitting in St. John's College in Santa Fe. You know, when I was reading your book, I really felt as though I knew you from what you were saying. It wasn't that it was so intimate, but it just must have been the details that you put in or the emotion that was in it. So welcome to Women's Focus.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here talking with you.
This is the first time that you've done a memoir. You've written lots, but not a memoir, as I understand.
I have been very reticent about talking about my life, my private life, with the exception of saying that I was a mother of a boy who's now grown up and is a man. And I was motivated to put this collection together from that point of view as the mother of a young brown man that I raised most of his life, not all of it, from preteen years through adulthood in the city of Chicago. The newer material in the book is also about my own growing up in Chicago and my experiences, which we hear now a lot about that city, and so I've reflected on that. And yes, I do pay attention to detail. I do believe that that's how we pull out memory from the recesses of our mind, is we grab onto some small thing and then see where it leads us. There are also earlier works in there. The earliest essay is called My Mother's Mexico, which was published over 20 years ago. And for a very long time, I thought that I would do a collection entitled My Mother's Mexico and talk about myself as a daughter of an indigenous Mexican woman who came to work in Chicago and so on. But my mother's been long gone from this world. And as time has gone on, I have found my role to be much more as mother than as daughter. So there's a long period of time that's covered in these essays. Also, some of them are, by definition, memoir, and yet others address social issues, and I would categorize them as personal essays.
Yes, you certainly bring in thoughts and what's happening in the world, and maybe that's what makes it seem so much that I know you from reading them. I want to talk about bringing up a son, but let's just tell our listeners now what your connection is with New Mexico, since we're doing this for a New Mexico audience, and where you're living now.
Well, I've actually had my current sanctuary, respite from the world, the madness of the world, out in the Chihuahuan Desert in southern New Mexico, and that's been some 13 years now. I don't know that people really know that or knew that. As I said, I've been very private about my life, but that's been my home for some time now. And it's the second time I lived in New Mexico, made it my home. Many years ago, I lived in Albuquerque. It was around the time that I wrote my novel, So Far From God, and finished my book, Massacre of the Dreamers. Well, in my newer residence, some years ago, I was able to do the updated 20th anniversary edition of that book, Massacre of the Dreamers, which was again issued by University of New Mexico Press. And currently, this is my second summer teaching with Bread Loaf, Middlebury College's summer master's program, which is housed by St. John's College here in Santa Fe. So I seem to have all kinds of connections and entries back into New Mexico.
When I heard that you lived on a mesa in southern New Mexico, and having read your story, I thought, well, that's perfect. She must feel as though it's home, even though it isn't where you grew up, because it's kind of a place where your different worlds could come together.
Well, it's interesting because I found this place very haphazardly, and it really is out of the way, and it's right on the fence line with Board of Land Management, desert land, and so it's pretty isolated in that sense, and it's just desert. It's not fertile land. It's not a place for gardeners and, you know, people who like green, but somehow it did call to me. One of the first things that I did when I first obtained the property was not to do anything at all with changing the house or, you know, making it my own, but I had contracted local workers to build a little chapel for me, and it's constructed with adobes that were made there from that very land. It's a nice size chapel, and it's dedicated to Our Lady of Guadalupe. I felt that it was a place that was calling me, and I did feel like it was my place. Now, I don't have a position there, a teaching position nearby, and I have to travel quite a bit to earn my living and to, you know, to have paid my mortgage and to pay for that little chapel. So I end up spending some part of the year invariably somewhere else, but I always go back there, and I do consider it home. Pablo Neruda said, home is where your books are, and my books haven't been moved, thank God, since I moved there, because those of us who love books and have made literature our lives, we only know how many tons those could end up weighing. So they've found a home. They're not going anywhere.
Well, when starting your memoir, you talk a lot about your mother, and she's a very strong character in it. And then you end it with thoughts about your mother also, and she's kind of changed over the years. But let's talk about your mother and how she was really brave.
Well, the interesting thing with my mom was, you know, as I mentioned, she was indigenous. Her mother and grandparents were indigenous from the state of Guanajuato, and she had a very somber sort of stoic attitude. And so visually, if you saw her, you immediately assumed that this is an immigrant woman. Now, the interesting thing about her was that she was actually born in the state of Nebraska in the 1920s, when we had a great big building boom and the railroads were being constructed, and Mexico and the U.S. were just the greatest of associates and chums. And this is when my maternal grandparents came to the United States. We keep in mind historically that it wasn't until 1924 that we have the Border Patrol set up. So before that, prior to that, obviously people came and left pretty freely. So my grandparents were here for a long time. I would guess maybe up to 10 years. You know, many communities, Mexican communities, were established, not just along the border, but into the Midwest and up north, including, you know, where my grandparents were, and my mother was born in the Midwest. In 1929, with the stock market crash, it is estimated that up to 1 million Mexicans and their American-born children were deported to Mexico. My mother was just 2 years old, and not long after that, she was orphaned. Both of her parents died one after the other. I estimate that it may have been tuberculosis, which was an epidemic at that time. It sounds to me like that might have been the case. At 11 years old, she ends up being a full-time domestic servant in a home in Mexico City, which is where her grandparents settled. When she was a young teenager, they moved to the border because their grandchildren were American-born grandchildren. And so they wanted the grandchildren to be able to get to go to school, get a better life, so they were able to cross them over. So my mother, as a teenager, is working then on the other side of the border. She has an unfortunate circumstance where she's taken advantage by her boss. She ends up being taken, you know, by him in those days. He was married in those days. Well, her grandfather had him be accountable to the children. But then at some point, when she's about early 20s, she follows American-born cousins to the Midwest, and she comes with her two little children to Chicago. This is where she ends up meeting my father, who was born in Chicago, and then I was born the following year. Yeah.
What I especially remember from your accounts of her is the look, her look that she would give, and apparently it wasn't something that you crossed.
For the life of me, I have tried that look on my son. That didn't work that well, and I've tried it on my granddaughter, and it doesn't faze her at all. But my mother just gave us that look, and many of us from, you know, strict Mexican background, we know that look, somewhere like a cross between Clint Eastwood and, I don't know, some you know, dictator. And it wasn't that she was, you know, going to fling her shoe at you or ground you. It was just the look was enough. You went somewhere with her. You sat there quietly. If they ask you, do you want something to drink? Would you like some water or soda? You have to say no. Don't accept anything. Don't talk. Don't interrupt. So that was my mom. However, as time went on and I became a woman and I began to see her aging and I began to see her woman to woman, I began to see that she was also felt herself very marginalized in this society. She did see herself as somebody from a humble background, and it wasn't enough that somebody spoke Spanish. It was class, it was race, and she did feel very much an outsider, and it tore at me to see my mother herself feel in public spaces that she didn't belong there. Even when I was the star of the show, you know, if it was a place I was speaking at or an award ceremony, she would sort of shrink into the background. And I do talk about that in this book, because I have found that in my life, curiously, I have those moments too. I have that moment of that fearlessness that my mother had to fight for, you know, survival and for her children. But in mainstream white society in particular, I go in and out of feeling that displacement.
Well, I guess that's what struck me was at the end of the book, you talk about her, and she's lost stature because she's gotten old, but she also seems to be not as formidable a person as she was when you were growing up and she was your mother. Your parents both worked in factories and were gone certain times during the week, and that was very strict, and so there wasn't much time for family time or for leisure.
Well, my parents had an interesting marriage. They actually lasted all the way until my father's early passing. They were married approximately 40 years. But the first 15 years of their marriage, he was a young father, he was a young husband, he wasn't ready to have a family, he wasn't ready for the stepchildren, he certainly wasn't even ready for me, and then I was a daughter. He didn't know what to do with the girl. Yeah. And in more traditional culture, he's got the freedom to go out on weekends on his own with his friends. He doesn't have to be answerable to my mother. My mother takes on all the responsibility of the household chores. Because my older siblings left home early, she passed some of that responsibility on to me. So I talk about my weekends with my mother and doing all the household chores and even making tortillas and going to the laundromat and learning how to iron and my father's clothes. We're doing all of that stuff while he's out driving around with his pals and having a good time. And so after about 15 years of that nonsense, she put a stop to that. But by this point, I'm a teenager, and mm-hmm. so I don't really want to be hanging around with my parents. And again, they really didn't know how to relate to me or were not that interested. I think they worked very hard during the week, and on the weekends they had the household chores, the groceries, some errands to run, and then, you know, maybe some social time with extended family. And they really weren't the kind of people that were thinking like, well, we have this teenage girl here, maybe she needs a ride here, or what social activities has she planned for herself? So I did talk about in the book quite extensively about my own teenage years, my teenage angst, which occurred in the late 60s and early 70s in Chicago. And Chicago was a very tumultuous and important city in the late 60s and early 70s. This is where we had the riots of the Democratic Convention, and Martin Luther King Jr. went through there when I was just starting high school. And, you know, he's murdered, and Bobby Kennedy's killed. And, you know, there's the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, establishes martial laws. This is kind of a quasi-military radical atmosphere that I'm being made aware of in my environment, and with or without anybody interpreting that for me in my home, I begin to observe it as a young, growing girl. And so while I'm also negotiating my newly developing female body and who I am and who am I as a Mexican or a Mexican-American or a Latina that looks foreign in this city that's so ethnically divided, economically divided. All of those things are going on at the same time that I'm aware of the news from the newspaper and the daily news. Vietnam was happening. This is a time of great change. So my parents weren't part of that because, as I said, they were living a very modest working class life, but I began to shape my own way of thinking. And I talk about that, as I said, also, and how do we become the people who we are? And some of it is family, and sometimes you make yourself.
You talk about not really being accepted either in the racially divided town, that either side thought of you as the other and didn't really accept you, and that must have been difficult.
It's still an argument that I think is valid in this country, although there has been some progress. And when we talk about racism or racial issues or civil rights, we have tended to look at it as a black and white issue. And certainly Chicago had a large white population and a substantial black population that was part of this dialogue at this time during the civil rights movement. And while I see myself being rejected by whites as not being American, not being white, that must mean you're poor, that must mean, you know, you're an immigrant, that must mean you don't have an education, it also is also that you don't speak English, there was always that assumption, you know. So all of that was going on. I also didn't fit in with the black community because obviously I'm not black, and it's not just even a question of color or how you look, but also culture. So I have a different culture. And so with the beginning of the Chicano movement, the Latino movement, as that begins to form, we begin to bring up the differences between that and trying to get our society to recognize the injustices that are also hailed against other peoples of color. Now, we're at a place now where this is a very, very fervent dialogue and heated one all across the board in every direction, and sometimes from surprisingly different directions. You never know really what side somebody's going to fall on sometimes. But I do think that there's a little bit more understanding with the African-American community and the Latinos who are advocates for the, you know, immigrants, for the young people who are going to school here, who are undocumented. It's a complex conversation. I, for one, I remain part of it, very, very interested and very vocal about this, but I also expand that conversation globally because our economy has changed so much that the jobs are now elsewhere, and the immigration problems that we have here are worldwide. As I've traveled around the world, I see the parallels and the very similar parallel situations that we have all over the planet, and I as a poet, would wish that we could have a more of a global dialogue about some of these things than keeping them exclusively to us and trying to find a solution that just works, you know, for this country.
Yes, yes. Talk a little bit about finding your voice as a writer, because that is also something that took a lot of experimenting and working, and it wasn't something that was a given or just sort of that you fell into.
Well, I seem to have loved to read and write since I started holding a pencil and found my first little books around that were laying around, however they came into my little hands. But I took that for granted, and what I really thought I was going to do creatively was to be a visual artist. So for a very long time, that's what I thought, although I would handwrite stories and illustrate them and write what now I realize were the beginning of verses and so on. In the early 70s, when I went to community college and I was thinking, you know, what I was going to major and what I was going to do, and I really loved art, but, you know, you want to also be practical, and I'm thinking about being a school teacher or maybe a social worker, do something to contribute, as I said, to those times. I was still drawing, but I was also writing, and somehow the writing just started taking more hold, especially in the beginning, the free-form verses, which I saw myself as a political poet, and I started publishing a little bit here and there, never with any grand ideas that I would get published by any major publishing house, because at that time, Latinas were not published by the mainstream. There was there weren't people with Spanish last names published by the mainstream, and even the smaller nice literary houses didn't recognize people who were from Latin America. The first ones were the Latin American boom, who were in translation, of course. Very different experience from being born and raised in the belly of the beast, so to speak, when you have Garcia Marquez talking about it as the beast, but here we are as little, you know, Mises in Chicago that are saying, hey, we're here, and we're also brown, and we also speak Spanish, and, you know, and we also know these countries. So as time went on, I made that decision in my 20s that this would be the the contribution that I would give. This would be the way that I would express myself also creatively. But I found out somewhere in my mid-20s that everybody writes poetry, and so I decided that, and not everybody reads it, that was the important thing. And so I began to expand those stories and those ideas into prose. And then from the prose, I went to the nonfiction and the critical essays. And, you know, I've covered just about every genre, mm-hmm. always and sometimes addressing the same stories, but in very different ways mm-hmm. to different audiences.
Well, you're also very prolific. You've published a lot of books. I guess it's that you really were writing all the time.
Well, I always tell people, and I've said this for a very long time, that I really don't have much of a social life. And it does keep me out of trouble. And I don't know, maybe I do have the quintessential poet's novelist personality, that sort of quiet, reserved, maybe a little bit antisocial, if you will. I prefer my own company. This is why I can live out in the desert most of the time. You know, I enjoy a nice social event. I like to go, you know, to hear music and theater and all of those things when I feel like it. But generally, I could go for a very long time with my own thoughts and work. And so, yes, I have been very busy with my writing, and I don't see myself, as long as my health and mental health remains, ever stopping writing and thinking. It's a challenge as you grow older to keep up with the world around you. From when you write, initially, your first novel, my first novel was The Miskiawala Letters, which I started in my 20s, and in your 20s, you think you've got all the answers mm-hmm. to the world, and you're the witness that's going to tell everybody what nobody else has noticed. And quite often, to some degree, that's true, because you are looking at it with fresh adult eyes as a poet and as a novelist. I was a self-taught novelist. I didn't know at all how to approach it. I just knew this is what I wanted to talk about. But as time has gone on, and I've written and published numerous novels now and essays and addressed and made observations about the world around me, I have to be very careful that I'm not talking about a world that I knew once upon a time, but in fact the world that filled with social media and the sound bites and the views that a 20-year-old is discovering today.
I'm talking to Ana Castillo, and we're talking about her latest book is Black Dove, and it was published by the Feminist Press, which is really great. I think it must have been wonderful to work with them.
It's the second book I have with the Feminist Press, and I am very grateful and very pleased with that relationship. The first was a novel that was published 2 years ago. It's called Give It to Me. As a self-taught writer and independent scholar and looking at life, and, you know, I inform myself where I go, and I do like everybody else, and I look it up on Google and see what I'm doing. I realized that this novel, Give It to Me, actually falls under the rubric of transgressive literature. So it wasn't exactly a story that was going to go mainstream. Mm-hmm. So when I showed it to the editor at the Feminist Press, who we were in relationship because they had accepted to do a collection of essays, which would later become the second book. Mm-hmm. When I showed it to them, they said they fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. They hated the original title, so they had a different title. We hate the title, but we love the book. So I knew that I'd found a home for it, because it's very difficult to write what you really feel you need to write and want to write today and get that support from a publisher. You invariably do get dissuaded to appeal to the quote-unquote wider audience, code for selling books. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that the Feminist Press, like many small presses and medium presses, have done the work of maintaining literature in this country and in other countries, mm-hmm. along with poetry.
Well, let's talk about feminism, because you also talk about that in your book, talking about becoming a feminist Chicana thinker.
Well, I wrote a book called Massacre of the Dreamers, which was probably the hardest challenge I've ever had, because it was critical essays, and it was written and put together in a time in which it was before the internet, for one, but also because at that time we didn't really have published scholarship by and about Chicanas and Latinas. So I really was going out there and trying to put together and find documentation that verified what I knew and I experienced and what I knew other women of color experienced in this country, and begin to define feminism for us, which in addition to gender and issues of sexuality, and we can also have the intersectionality of class. You know, we had some outstanding black activists from the late 60s, from the 60s, that I used their work to substantiate some of those arguments. But we also have our history and the relationship of Mexico with the United States that had to be addressed. And so I began to form an analysis that I eventually called a Chicanismo with an X. You know, I used to go and give readings from my fiction and poetry, and when people asked me, and most of my readers were women at that time, you know, what are you working on? And I would say, well, I'm working on this book of feminist essays. They would make crosses like, you know, this was not something for us. This is a white woman's thing. And maybe black and white women could dialogue about it, but we had other business at hand. And so I found that it was very important to get a label, to get a word for it. And the word is out there now. I think there's a whole new generation maybe redefining it, Chicanismo. Mm-hmm. But that was the beginnings of establishing that there was a different kind of feminism, and that was very specific to our history and the relationship that we have, the economic relationship that we have with the United States, which is very different from, and not to say better or worse, than people, immigrants from other countries. But we happen to share this border with the United States. Then this label is added to me. You know, it can't just be a writer or a poet, but now I'm a Chicana feminist writer. And so there you have it. So, you know, and give it to me, you kind of suspect what's going to happen with my characters. They're always these, you know, very spunky, independent women. They're, you know, I hope fearless. If not in this last novel, Give It to Me, sometimes I wonder about her, but she ends up okay. So I put her in the, you know, a lot of situations I wouldn't put myself in. And then with the essays, some of them were published earlier on, like in Oxygen.com and Salon.com. So they do have that tone of the independent woman, but also mother and conscientious observer in our society. And then when I begin to talk very privately, very personally, I don't know if it dispels what we seem to understand about a feminist. You know, we think of a feminist going out and she's, you know, a scientist, or, you know, she has a job and she seems to be above household chores and things like, well, I don't know who's doing that if it's not you when you come home, because nobody else is going to do it. Or maybe you do have a partner that's doing it, or maybe you do hire somebody to come and do it. But, you know, so I talking personally as a mother and spiritually, I think you see all those dimensions.
Well, let's talk about you as a mother, because talking about your son is an important part of the memoir also. And I had a son who was my only child, so I really enjoyed your thoughts about it.
Well, I consciously made the decision to be a mother when I was 30 years old. And I knew that the challenge to be a writer was already big enough. There wasn't a space for a Latina, a Chicana writer. That just didn't exist. Maybe in small radical groups, that's where I was at, but, you know, to think about it as a career, as a life choice. And I knew that the challenges were going to be substantial, but at 30 years old, and I was married at the time, I decided that I wanted to have a child and experience that. And so I have taken my role as mother very seriously. It has been a very important, if not the most important role that I've taken on. And my son was, you know, an only child and was raised with me, of course, as I said, and got the benefits of understanding the importance of education, a musical education, and so on. But what I didn't realize when he was a teenager was that he was living two lives. Mm-hmm. One is the life that he's learning with me and in school, and he went right through school. He did very well. He never gave me any problems. But then when he leaves home, when they walk out the door, a brown young man or, you know, a young woman of color, they're viewed very differently from the precious family members that they are to us. And for men of color, they begin to adapt to an aggressive environment. They are treated aggressively by other men, and in my son's case, by the Chicago police, by the thugs in the area. Mm-hmm. There certainly were, you know, gang members. And he begins to develop a posturing and another personality, a definition of what it is to be a man outside of the things that he's taught at home or at his school. And as he becomes a man in his 20s, I have discussed in this book how painful it was to see him spiral emotionally and become very angry, and how he was responding to society. And it's not for me to judge another person's journey, and I guided him as well as I could. But when my son spiraled completely and then ultimately ended up in federal prison for 2 years, it was completely heartbreaking. It's probably the hardest thing that I've endured because of my love and dedication to being a mother, raising a child, and being so proud as a single mother that I had done so well by him, that it was saddened me more than anything was to see how angry and upset he was. So I've addressed this in memoir. People have asked me about my son. He has an essay in the book that he wrote during the time he was incarcerated, and a few of our letters or exchanges are in there so that we could hear his voice.
Oh, I like that.
But also, it was important that people understand that as a family, we've made a decision to put our story out there, one for our own healing, healing our family, but also because there's so much behind this that we need to address in our culture and in our society. The extent of people of color that are incarcerated, the justice system, and who goes to rehab and who gets sent to prison, that we see constantly over and over again. The laws that we have right now that continue to admonish people who have done their time, served their time, and when they come out, they are discriminated against in applying for jobs and applying for a home, for housing. So all we're doing is continuously pushing certain groups in our society further and further out, and then castigating them, and then when they become offenders or repeat offenders, saying, well, you see, that's how they are. That's how those people are. And we are supporting a multi-billion dollar prison industry. There's a lot of money behind this that we could put in different places for different purposes. And so my son and I want to have this discussion with the public, and we have a place to speak about it now personally.
I loved the letters that you exchanged and getting his answers back, especially the one that I especially liked was when he started questioning
patriarchy.
Yes, and you didn't really have an answer, but you started talking about it.
I didn't want to get into professor mode, the feminist studies professor mode at that moment. I do have feelings about an alternative global economy, obviously. I have a lot of opinions, and I do have feelings about an alternative to the world that we live in that's dominated by male superiority in general all over the world, even if we have female leaders, women leaders. But I feel that that's right now for me, and it's a dream, a poet's vision.
I'm talking to Ana Castillo about her book, A Black Dove.
Well, when my son was incarcerated, this was hitting the low point of his, what I saw as a clinical depression, a disconnect. He wasn't even recognizable to me when I went to see him in his arraignment. I really don't know, and maybe I will never know everything that went on with him in his head at that time to lead him to those choices. And it took a while for him to begin to communicate well. You know, he seemed very despondent, and I didn't, as I said, it was not the young, intellectually curious young man I knew. How I knew best through those emails and through correspondence to get him back was, in fact, through books. And I realized in writing these essays, speaking for myself, even as a girl, you mentioned, you know, my parents being busy working. Books were my teachers and my friends, as we find is a truth for many writers. It was the case for me. I got my books from the library when I discovered there was the Chicago Public Library. That's like the greatest treasure in the world. And so with my son, of course, I was reading to him since he was a child. He was a good reader, he's a good writer, but he was so despondent, we could hardly communicate. So what I started to do was send him books, and we would read them together. We would talk about them that way. And so what you see in these brief exchanges that I shared in Black Dove is us talking about books. We were talking about artists. Basquiat was somebody he was very interested in. My son had been and is still very much admirer of hip-hop culture and a little bit in it, you know. He was a graffiti artist. This was some of the things that caused him some troubles as a teenager. And so I knew Basquiat since before when my son was just a child. I'm also, you know, interested in the art. So we could talk about that. We talked about rappers like Commons, and we read his book, and he sent his copy to me with Marginalia. This is how we began to connect. And by the time his time was served, I actually did begin to see already now the glimpses of the young man that I had raised and known because of those conversations that we're having, that he's again appreciating, not just observing the world, but analyzing and taking some joy and pleasure in the things that this world does offer. Where when he was very depressed, there's just nothing but cynicism.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you dedicated the book to him and to your granddaughter.
He had a little girl before he spiraled down emotionally, you know, the light of his life, and certainly now the light of all our eyes in her family. We adore her, as you would at your first grandchild. She was given my name, my full name, and to my absolute delight, she's left-handed, as I am. So I have great hopes for her as far as her creativity goes, but she is very emphatic that she wants to be a scientist. So good luck to her, because we don't happen to have a scientifically minded background in our family. But in any case, I do talk about her also toward the end of the book. And interestingly enough, the conversation is because on her side, her mother's side of the family, they are atheists. And so her mother told her little girl that there's no God. And so the conversation that I'm having with the reader and the public is my own journey, my own spiritual journey, in trying to explain to my granddaughter that I think she should hold off, or maybe in time she will reevaluate that there's more out there than nothing and Santa Claus. Because apparently there is a Santa Claus.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you made the decision to share your life and to make it public, and so that all of us could enjoy it and could learn from it. I'm talking to Ana Castillo, and the name of the book is Black Dove. And
I'll be doing a reading in Santa Fe on the 13th of July at 6 p.m. I do believe the famous little granddaughter will be there signing with me. She signs books with me, since she's also in that essay. There's a photograph of her in there. And then on the 17th of July, we will be at Bookworks in Albuquerque at 4 o'clock.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.